there's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Hi guys, Jack Spirko here with a kind of a sort of a guerrilla version of the podcast. What you're about to hear is the audio presentation portion of the How to Start a Permaculture Business presentation that I did at Permaculture Voices last week. As you can hear right here, my voice is bad. I'm still recovering from whatever crud that I got from being on an airplane. And now I got to go get on another airplane this afternoon and head up to parts undisclosed. I'll just say it's the northeastern United States and working on something for PermaEthos. Can't fully tell you about yet, but you'll hear about it actually, and you've probably heard about it some already, but you'll hear about it in this presentation at the end of it. I won't consider this an official numbered show. I will push it out into the feed as a podcast, but since there's no sponsors included or anything, it's not fair to them that I number it. So this will be Guerrilla Podcast 2, I guess. And there might be enough travel coming that there might be more of this type of thing in the future. Monday you'll probably get a show that'll be from the place we're going with Joe and I and maybe some surprise guests. I'll leave it at that. And we'll tell you more about what's going on Monday when we're on a plane on our way back here. And with that, I do hope you enjoy this presentation. This actually isn't the exact presentation I gave in Voices. This was my run-through. It ran about an hour and 15 minutes, so I had to shorten it by about 15 minutes. So you actually get a little more than people got on-site in California. Anyway, let's go ahead and roll the audio from the presentation.
Hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko today to talk to you about building a successful permaculture business. And there's a real desire out there among permaculturists to move permaculture from something maybe that we do for ourselves in our own backyards into something that we do in the backyards of others as a profession, and to do something to actually turn permaculture from an idea and something that we can all do into something that can actually make us a living. Because many people that get involved with permaculture find that it really turns on a fire and a passion in them. And there's actually nothing better that you can build a business with other than something that you have a passion for and a fire for. I know I feel that way about permaculture. While I am a podcaster by trade, and I do permaculture mainly for myself with some classes every year, actually I consider my business a permaculture business. It's a huge segment of what I do, and hopefully part of what you'll learn today is that you can be in a permaculture business without everything you do being directly related to the agricultural components of permaculture. You might teach. There's a lot of different avenues that we'll go over today, but I want to start out with something that I think that I really wouldn't have to say in talking about most businesses to most people that want to build a business. But I feel due to some of the politics that get drug into permaculture that, in my view at least, have no real place there, that I do need to say this today, and that is that a successful business is profitable. There's a lot of talk I hear about using a 501c3 not-for-profit model of permaculture. The 501 model, the not-for-profit model, actually can allow the people that own that business to make quite a bit of money. It's not necessarily non-profit. It's the business itself is not run for the purpose of a profit, but that's a specific type of structure. And I feel in many conversations with people in permaculture that a lot of people want to be a nonprofit, not because the legal and tax structure makes sense, but because like profit's dirty. If you learn nothing else from me today, learn that if your business is not profitable, your business is doomed. Profit is not evil. Profit is not bad. In permaculture, one of our primary principles is obtain a yield. And if we have a system that does not create a yield, it's not a fertile system. It's not a fruitful system. It doesn't provide anything in return for all the inputs and labor that go into it. A business works the same way. There has to be a yield. And in business, a profit is a yield. Now, many of you know this and are like, well, duh. But we have to take it from there because a lot of people understand, I want to be in business. I want to make money. I want to do good things. I want happy customers. I want to be a happy person. But if you've never run a business before, there's a lot of things that are necessary to think about in a business, And I can't go through all of them today. I could teach a course that would go 3 or 4 weeks to actually get into the in-depth components of what makes a business successful. But I want to give you the 7 things that I know that every business that's profitable always does and does up front. And if you can't define these things and put these things in place at the beginning of your business, it's like trying to do permaculture at the bottom of the ocean. I guess it could be done, but there's sure as hell some lot easier ways to do it. So number one is the business mission is well defined. I ask people all the time, what's the purpose of your business? To make lots of product and sell it. That's not your mission. Or with a permaculture business, to get clients and to put really cool systems in backyards. It's not your mission. Your mission has to be very specific, 1 to 4 sentences, and easily understood. And when you hear the person say, the mission of my business is, it shouldn't sound like marketing speak. It should sound in a way that a person who you're telling about your business goes, oh, I get what this business does. I understand this business. I understand why I would want to do business with this company or why I'd want to tell somebody else about it. If it doesn't do that, you do not have it well defined. 2 sentences or less is a better rule than 4. But depending on your business and how much it does, I may say that it would be acceptable up to 4 sentences. But if you can't say it in 60 seconds or less, it's too long. Next, the revenue model is well defined. Where does your money come from? Customers. That is not a revenue model. Okay, we'll talk about revenue models in this presentation today. But a revenue model is along the lines of our educational revenue model is based on the production of audio video product that are sold through, you get, I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but that's a revenue model. That would be one piece of your total revenue model. And a good business has multiple streams of income, which you see is a later point. I probably should bring that up in the presentation a bit because the two are so intrinsically entwined. But you absolutely have to have more than one source of revenue, and each model for the revenue must be clearly defined. You must understand how they interact with each other. Both models should be able to be explained in a few sentences or less. Just like your mission statement should be easy to understand and easy to explain, if I were a venture capitalist and you were asking me for $500,000 and you couldn't tell me your business mission and your revenue model in less than a minute and a half, I'm done. I'm not even talking to you. I don't care how good your idea is. My response to you would be, even if you have the greatest idea for a business in the world, even if you have the right instincts, you're not ready yet to actually be in business because you haven't done these very basic 2 things. The next thing is the business must be resilient. And that's part of having multiple revenue streams, but it's also part of understanding your place in the market. It's part of understanding what you are going to run into as far as problems and yet not letting the fact that there could be a problem prevent you from getting started. So many people, when you talk to them about a business, well, what if this and what if that? And I'm like, you'll never know. You'll never have a clue what if until you get there. Because the what if in your head is not going to be like the what if on the ground. But you do need to go through those enough to understand it's not going to be all sunshine and roses, and you're going to have to get through tough times. And you need a plan for how you'll do that. So things like, I can survive for 6 months without any cash flow are good, but you don't need to be planning to have no cash flow for 6 months. You need to be planning to have some cash flow, because if you can't get any at all, you've got a real problem. And then you need to be tactically figuring out how the financial reserve you have can get you through the lean periods, just like you would determine how the water reserve you create can get you through the dry season. The next thing is, the business is easy to do business with. If you don't make your business easy to do business with, shockingly enough, there'll be people that never do business with you that would have otherwise. That means that it needs to be clear to a customer when they look at your website or any type of literature you put out or when they talk to you, well, this is how I do business with this person. This is the type of payment they accept. This is the type of thing that they do. This is how they can come out and actually apply a solution on my property and what I would be expected to do to get that done. That it wouldn't be like, well, how do I get you to my property? I mean, that should be very, very clear. And a person should be able to buy from you as easy as you can make it. And that means if you're selling a product that ships, it should be click a button and buy like Amazon. If you're doing consulting, it should be, your model should be defined, let's say, on a website with a very simple questionnaire for the customer to fill out. And when they submit that, then you can get in contact with them, and you've gathered some information already. And the information you've gathered has started the process of doing business together. Like, how big is your property? What type of budget have you allocated? So you know if the person qualifies for your time. And by asking the right questions, you will actually be helping that customer understand how to do business with you from the beginning. And also understand, I believe that permaculture itself is a business model. Permaculture is not a way to grow fruit and nuts. It is a design science. So we can use it to design a business just as well as we can use it to design a property. A successful business also has 8 forms of capital. Now understand when I say capital, that there is a way that the IRS defines things like assets, liabilities, and capital and how they apply to income. These definitions of capital are absolutely not approved by the IRS, and I do not want you to use them in your financial balance sheet as such, but in your design and management of your business, I think these are very important things to look at. These come from a gentleman named Ethan Rowland, and you can find him at appleseedpermaculture.com. You see the link there in the bottom of the slide. With that link, you can actually read a whole article on these. I can't go into all of them deeply, because that would take the entire time we have for the presentation today. But I do want to talk about them at a high level quick so you can start thinking about defining the value proposition of your business a little bit differently. Number one, social capital. Social capital is the most valuable form of capital that a business can have, in my opinion. A business with solid social capital can always get more business. It can always find another customer. It can always find another source of funding. It can always get whatever it needs to continue to grow and develop, even if it's fallen on hard times. With good social capital, people will want to do business with you. And if people want to do business with you, they'll find a way. Social capital is your ability to influence the actions of a marketplace simply because you are you. Financial capital. Briefest one I'm going to go over because we basically get this. This is money. Financial capital has to be managed in stages, though. You have to think about potential financial capital, the money that you can expect that your business should earn based on a forecast going into the next cycle of business, the next quarter or annual cycle. The other type of financial capital is the capital you have on hand. You also have what you call your future money that's known. This is the part of your forecasted revenue that already exists. In other words, you have contracts in place with customers who have already signed the contract, you're already engaged, and that's not a guess at the additional business this year, that's business on the books that is yet to be collected. You also have to look at the financial capital out. How much money are you going to be spending? Most people, when they hear financial capital, they only think about it in one direction, inward. You also have to think about it outward. You also have to think about your living capital. Living capital, you can look at it if you own a beautiful property, and on your property, you've permacultured your property, and if you're going to be a designer, or you're going to be in a business asking to teach people about design, or sell them propagated cuttings, or anything else we're going to talk about today, your property better look good. And if it doesn't look good, it better because you just got it, and you're developing it, and you better be documenting all of it. But if you have a beautiful living backyard, and when somebody says, well, what can you do for me? You go, I can do this for you. Buddy, that's capital. And that certainly influences your financial capital, and it certainly gives you social capital. But living capital is that. It's also the life of your business. A good business actually becomes a living entity. You think about what makes something alive, and one is that it reproduces. That's how we define life. Even a virus or a yeast reproduces, and therefore we know it's alive. And if something's not alive, if it's inert, it doesn't reproduce. It just sits there. It does nothing. We cultivate life in permaculture. Well, we want to cultivate a living capital of our business. A business that has the other 7 elements of capital balanced will be alive. Your business literally will grow itself. It will constantly be bringing things into you, creating abundances that you aren't even aware of, that something you started 5 years ago is coming back to you as a butterfly flipped its wings across the universe. That butterfly effect is the living capital in a business. The intellectual capital is what the business knows, what you know, what your staff knows. But if you're smart, you want your intellectual capital to be much bigger than what you know and what the consultants that you use and the suppliers you use know. You want your intellectual capital also be your customers' knowledge. So if one customer tells you something, I planted this plant and it did wonderfully, you become the vector of that information to the next customer. The customer that you're talking to tomorrow doesn't care if you know that plant A does beautifully in their garden because you read it in a catalog, you studied it in school as a botanist, because you planted it yourself or because one of your other customers told you. They just need to know that you know it, and they need you to transmit that information to them so that you can bring them value. So think about your intellectual capital tent as being very, very big and encompassing as many people as you can get. And if you can actually build communities on social platforms like Facebook and Twitter and forums where your customers actually directly exchange information, that becomes knowledge in your business as well. Too many business people want to control all their IPR, all their intellectual property rights. They don't want any, it's like semi-secret sauce. Well, the secret sauce days are over. Those are dinosaur businesses. Permaculture is an evolutionary, not a revolutionary, an evolutionary business model, an evolutionary design science. The free exchange of information is value. And if customers freely exchange information among themselves because of you, they will value you and do business with you wherever they can and wherever makes sense to them. So you don't have to control and hold all the information. Your intellectual capital needs to be a big, broad tent, and you need to hold on to the knowledge the way that you would hold on to sand. If you hold on to sand with a tight, firm grasp, you end up with almost no sand. If you let a lot of sand in between your fingers and hold sand loosely, you can actually hold a lot of sand in your hands. That applies to money as well, by the way. Human capital. This is the people in your business, even if it's just yourself. There's a value in being a human being. There's a value to being a life form, a human. People care is important in permaculture. And that means that the human capital has value, your employees, your contractors. But the human capital, again, we're back to big tent thinking. Human capital are your customers. Your customers are a capital asset of your business. And most times when one business buys another business, nobody ever understands they're buying a customer base before they're buying anything else, which tells you there's a human capital element in your customer base. And I think when people see human capital, they see this as a negative. They think that, oh my God, human capital, that's turning a person into property. No, it's acknowledging the human being's value as a being. I acknowledge your value, therefore you are valuable. And because you're part of what I do, you're valuable to me. You're part of the human capital element in my community or my business or where whatever part that we have a co-association with, you have value. I honor your value. Therefore, you're capital to this thing that's important to me. The next thing is spiritual capital. I don't care what your spiritual belief systems are. I believe that when you build a business that truly has living capital in its own essence, it also has to have spiritual capital. All living beings have a spiritual essence. And I don't, again, this has nothing to do with religion. I don't consider myself religious at all. I am what's called a deist. That means I believe in a God or a spirit that is the sum total of all things, an architect to the universe. I don't care if you're an atheist. There's still a spiritual component to who and what you are. There's a life force within your being. I can't take a dead human being and plug them into electricity and reanimate them and make them function. There's something living within all beings that make them function and reproduce and interact. And when we understand that spiritual nature, we can understand the concept that since that is me, that if I want to be successful, I have to worry about other living beings. And as I worry about other living beings, I then have to take my motivations beyond myself. I have to take them out into the marketplace, and I have to say to myself, I must bring value to my customer. I must change things in some way. And that means having a goal larger than myself, and your business should have a goal larger than yourself. And before you say my business's goal that's larger than myself is to establish a permaculture farm on the moon in a crater under a dome. That would be a big goal. But something that seems simple can be so much larger than yourself. If you lived in a small town of 5,000 people, I bet if you walked around right now and said, how many people know what the word permaculture means? The answer would be a very low number. If your simple answer to the goal larger than myself is, my business will have such an impact on my community that of the 5,000 people that live in and around it, 5 years from now, if you ask anybody what permaculture is, they'll know what the word means. That's bigger than branding your business. That's branding the idea that your business is founded on. And that means you're letting go of what's in it for you. And you're looking at it more as what's in it for my community. And if you do that, your business will grow. But by stepping outside of yourself, that's spiritual capital. You want that in your business. Cultural capital is the culture of your business, the culture of your community, the culture of your customers. It's why some companies attract the very best, even though they don't pay the very best. They pay good. They honor their employees. But people just want to work there because it's cool. That's a cool culture. Well, within permaculture, you want to build a cultural capital that's built on ethics. And if you build that, then ethical people will want to do business with you. And trust me, if you're going to be an ethical business, you need ethical customers. And if you have that, you have success. And the last is material capital. All of the things within your business, all the things that your business uses to accomplish its goals. And that one's easy to understand, so I'll leave it there. Again, Ethan Rowland came up with these concepts at Appleseed Permaculture. Now, the next thing, I don't know that I would have to say this if I was going out and teaching people how to set up a business as a consultant in IT. But I might. I don't know. But I know I have to do this here. A successful business acts like a successful business. They act like a business, period. Number one, do not be a walking lawsuit or a tax audit waiting to happen. I talked to a permaculturist recently, very, very good one, who, when I evaluated their business practices, I'm like, you are a walking lawsuit. You're waiting to be sued because you don't have an agreement with your customers, which you'll notice is my number one bullet point. But this was such a bad situation when I understood the totality of what this person was doing. Operating as a private citizen, not as a corporation. No written agreement with customers. No clearly defined objectives that they were invoicing against, etc. I was like, if I were an ambulance chasing lawyer and I found out about you, I would go find someone and tell them to hire you. Bring them to your property. Let you do whatever they want. Don't worry about what you do. And when you're done, come back to me and I'll find a way to sue you because you're that target rich of an environment. This is how business, unfortunately, is in America. So there's certain things you need to do. Number one, again, all consulting should be done with a written agreement. What you're going to do, what the customer's going to do. Heavy equipment, who rents it? Well, the customer does. Do you have something that says that? What notice do you need prior to that equipment arriving so you can be there the day the equipment arrives? How much time have you dedicated to be there with the equipment and the equipment operator? Who hires the equipment operator? Who pays for it? Who calls in locates to make sure you don't blow something up like a gas line or tear something out like an electrical line? Well, the customer's supposed to. It's their property. You better have that in agreement. You better, or they're going to say, I didn't know. I didn't know there were electric lines here. I had no idea. I hired this. You got it? You have to make sure that you're doing things in a way that protect your business. But it's more than that. You want happy customers? A customer needs to know what they're expected, is expected of them. And they need to know what they can expect from you. If you balance that, then it's very easy to make your customer happy because they don't have an unreasonable expectation. They're not like, well, he was supposed to do this or he was supposed to do that. If there's an objection, it comes up front early in the process where it can be addressed. Next, have a good CPA. The tax code is basically this way. Think of it as something as thick as a phone book. About what you would look at in like a normal composition book is what you have to do. The rest of the book is how you get out of doing most of it. CPAs know this and you don't. You need to be taking every deduction that you legally can, because if you don't, it's just like letting fertility ebb off of your property when you didn't have to and wondering why you're not more productive. If you went out and looked at a property for somebody and 80% of their fertility was washing off of their property and eroding their landscape, you'd say we have to stop this bleeding to heal the land. Well, if you have a business where a lot of your revenue and a lot of your productivity is going to people like the IRS, who I consider to be basically a pest, right? A leech-like pest, then you have no other answer as to why your business isn't profitable other than you're leaking profit. So a good CPA keeps you honest, keeps you safe, and keeps you protected from abuse by the parasite that is the Internal Revenue Service. The next, discuss your corporate entity with a CPA and a tax lawyer. I'm going to say that one again. Discuss your corporate entity with a CPA and a tax lawyer. Do you know, I notice I did not say a CPA or a tax lawyer. I said both. And it would be great after you've found your two to one you think you know what you're doing, have them talk to each other for about a 30-minute conversation to determine what the best course of action is so they know each other and they give you the best advice. Do not do this with LegalZoom.com. Now, once your lawyer says, yeah, this is what you should do, you can go to LegalZoom.com, get a form, and have your tax lawyer review it before you file it, and save yourself some money, but don't just go to LegalZoom and go, oh, I want an LLC, or oh, I want a 501 this, or you know, what have you. Because you probably don't know what you need. And that's why you hire an expert. You're asking people to hire you for your expertise in permaculture. Well, you're not an expert in tax law. And you're not an expert in corporate structure. And if you want your business to be successful, you have to model the behavior of your customers in your business. In other words, your business has to act like you, your customers should act. This is why it requires ethics. Okay? If you didn't have ethics, that could be a disaster. But if you have ethics and you do your business ethically, you treat your people with respect, both internally and externally, and on both sides of the company, you are as respectful and concerned for the good and well-being of your suppliers as your customers, then you can model the behavior of your customer in your dealings with others, the people you buy from, and have a lot of success. Next, set up business accounts, PayPal, merchant accounts, bank accounts, etc. Again, this is something I don't know that I should have to say, but I've seen people doing business and receiving money into their personal accounts. This is a disaster waiting to happen. It's called commingling of funds. If you're doing business as a sole proprietor, it's not that big a deal. And there might be some businesses you would run in permaculture as a sole proprietorship and not do a corporate structure. But if you're going on people's property and you're like instructing them in the use of heavy equipment and things like that, don't even think about it. But even if you're doing it as a sole proprietorship, I would still set up accounts that are independent of your personal use just to make your bookkeeping easy. Carry the necessary insurances and get a good agent. A good insurance agent isn't the one that your buddy told you about that's done a good job for him with home, car, and auto for the past 10 years. He's good as a consumer agent. You need to talk to some people around you that you know that are successful in business and the insurance agents that they use for their business insurance. It is a different world. Find good ones. And last but not least, accept Bitcoin because it pisses off the establishment. Absolutely, I believe if we're going to be an evolutionary business model, that we need to move into a new era of doing business person to person. And if we're not doing that, we're really missing a lot of opportunities. And actually, I consider Bitcoin to be a global let's system. In the Permaculture Designer's Manual, we hear about setting up permaculture communities and doing our internal commerce with let's. Local exchanges, right? So I'm going to give you this and you're going to give me that, but I don't need eggs and you want milk from me. So here's my milk. I don't want eggs. All you got's eggs. You basically give me script that only works in our community. I think Bitcoin's better than that because it's immediately exchangeable outside, but it does the same thing. Let's do it. Writes out the middleman. So let's now move into how we're going to make money in permaculture. What are the revenue streams? Remember I said your revenue models must be easily defined. Well, if we're going to define the revenue model, the first thing we have to do is determine what activity generates revenue. In other words, what is the source of the revenue? If I want to define the hydraulic model on a property, I have to ask first, where's the water come from? So show me the money. Let's start off with the educational revenue stream. This is something that is done a lot in permaculture, but I think we can only go to the well so many times, especially with parts of it. The biggest thing that most permaculturists sell, once they get fairly well defined and they're able to kind of stand up and do a good job of instructing, they've got some experience under their belts, is the PDC, Permaculture Design Certification, Permaculture Design Certificate. I think it's a great product. I wish everybody on planet Earth would go get a PDC. I also know that there's a lot of people on planet Earth that really won't ever, and some that it's not right for, at least not right yet. And there's a lot of other education that could be done that's more valuable for those individuals for the time. I actually feel that the PDC is one that is oversold and undervalued. It's oversold because a customer or a company knows if I can put 12 people into a PDC at $1,000 a person, I can make 12 grand. And if I can do that four times a year, I can make about 48 grand. And that's enough money to not live on like a king, but it's a lot more money than a lot of people in America make today in a middle-class lifestyle. It's a lot less money than you think it is if you've never been self-employed and paid self-employment taxes and all the other expenses that go with running a business, not to mention keeping the students happy and feeding them and stuff like that. But you can understand why somebody would think this way. Like, if I can get this to work, I can make enough money to have my baseline income. Well, the problem is that causes us to oversell it, and it also causes students to undervalue it. If you're overselling something, it will be undervalued to your customers. That's something you might want to write down. If you oversell to your customers, they will undervalue the product. In other words, if I overpromise to you and underdeliver, you're going to look at the value of what you received, and you won't even value it as much as it actually has value. Even if I sell it to you for something that you, in the end, you would have said to yourself, if you just paid $50 for something, you'd look at this and go, this is a $70 product. I just got a great deal. I got a $70 product for $50. Even if the product still fits that classification, if I sell it to you as being worth $100, even though you've only paid me $50, okay? And you know in your intrinsic mind that it is worth $70, you will still feel like I ripped you off for $30. And this is what happens with PDCs. We sell the PDC like we're selling a degree in architecture for 4 years of university training, and it's a two-week course, and it does a lot of great things, and it's totally worth $1,000, $1,200. It's totally worth it. But the way it's sold does not match the value the customer receives. So that's where I think PDCs have a weakness. To me, I should be selling PDCs to people that want a working future in permaculture or have done enough classwork work or individual research, have enough knowledge of permaculture to really understand kind of what it is, and they want to take it to another level and they understand what they're getting. Everybody else I should be selling something else to. Here's some things we can sell them, because this is your customer should be able to buy from you easily. So you should have lots of options that fit wherever they're at in the educational spectrum. If you are in education and the only thing you teach are PDCs, earthwork workshops, and urban courses, and that's it, you have big holes in your business model. Number two, workshops. This is where we start to branch out. Hands-on, multi-day specific classes, right? Or even one-day courses. We're going to sheet mulch today. Run a class, teach you guys how to sheet mulch. Here's where you get your materials, here's how we do it, and this is how you do this in your own backyard. You teach that a day. Students will pay $50 to $100 for a class like that. You can charge them $200. If you run a really good class, give them a place to camp out overnight, run it like an experience, feed the heck out of them, and you guys running permaculture workshops, get off the tabbouleh and the rice. Feed some people some meat. Animals are part of a permaculture system. You come to one of my workshops, and if you leave hungry, it's your fault. I mean, we do pork shoulder and brisket and things like that. If you're going to do that type of thing, you have to charge enough to deliver, but you can give them the experience that they're looking for, not just the education, but the interactivity. For things that are a little easier on people, they don't have to spend the night or they don't have to make a whole day of it. Just classes, one day or less affairs. An hour or three type of thing would be another way to look at this. I'm going to run a class on 20 plants that do wonderful in our climate that you've probably never heard of. Most of you would show up to that class. If it was in your backyard and I marketed that way and I just named one plant I was going to talk about, and you said to yourself, I've never heard of that plant. Or even if you had, you said, I've never heard anybody ever really talk about that plant. I thought I was the only one who knew. I wonder what else is going on there. I've got a hook now I'm going to bring you in. And I want these simple, low-cost classes, $25, $50 a seat, because I want to start cultivating a relationship with my customer the way I start cultivating a plant when it's very small that I know will grow into a great big tree someday. And I need a soft entry point, especially working the local market, which we'll talk more about in a second. The next one, written content, video content, audio content. This is both revenue and marketing. You should be putting out all kinds of free stuff. And whatever forms you're best at, writing, speaking, or video. I believe audio is the most powerful form of marketing because it's multifunctional marketing. It fits multifunctional lifestyles. You can drive in your car and listen to me talk. You can't really pay attention to a video or read while you're driving without seriously risking yourself and others. You can jog and listen. You can get on a machine at the gym to work out and listen. You can go in your garden. You can be chopping and dropping and having me sell to you while you're learning from me. So I love audio. But it's not just about putting it out as marketing. It's also about making money. For instance, you may be watching this video right now because you purchased a USB stick from me, and I sold it to you for not much more money than you would have spent just to buy the USB stick and had this content and other content on it. And I stacked that function into, I'm going to California to do this presentation. The students are all going to go, how can I get a copy of this? I'm going to say, here's how you get a copy of it. Buy this from me, and maybe I can afford to take my wife to a nice dinner while I'm out there off of the money that I'll make off of what I'm doing. So you're function stacking. If you're speaking at conferences or workshops or anything where people are coming, you should be taking every time you do a presentation, adding it to a file and simply selling it on zip strips. Or you could sell it as a download as well. Like, you can go to my site and click on this and get it. But I like the physical product when it's face-to-face stuff. People get it, they walk away with it. I buy the USB strips I use, the ones I'm using for this one, I get them for $5 on Tiger Direct. But if you bought one on Amazon instead of buying it in bulk, you'll pay $14.95. If I sell that for $24.95, I've only charged you $10 for the content, and you got the USB stick that you can reuse. If I sell it for $20, I'm selling it to you for $5. I'm selling you the product for $5 in your mind. I'm selling the product for about a $14 profit after tax and shipping. And that means I'm making a good return, better than I would selling an expensive book. And you're getting a better value because not only do you get the information and get to keep it permanently, but once you've taken the information off my USB stick, you can use it for anything that you would like. The big thing that's overlooked to me is location-specific education. Like I said, 20 plants that grow great in our climate you've never heard of. I think that permaculturists should really, in the educational market and consulting market, be making their biggest impact on a local level. We teach short food cycles, right? The food from the backyard to the plate, zero food miles, right? Well, then we should be doing business where we're planted. And there's plenty of business no matter where you are. Unless you live where there are no people, and that is a problem. As long as there are people around you, there are potential customers. And revitalizing your local economy is a goal larger than your business and would be a big part of your spiritual capital, and it's a noble thing that actually can get done. Next thing, the consulting revenue stream. This is the other thing. People want to just run out and do it right away. And what most people want to do is property planning and full design and project management. And do the work. Most people actually get these four, but they don't really get how they're separated from each other and what really goes into them. When you look at property planning, to me, this is where we're doing a basic design, what to plan, etc. This is the customer that says, look, I want to do most of this myself. I'm just kind of stuck. The best customer for this is the customer that really kind of could do it themselves. They're just not quite confident enough to do it yet. They want some ideas on what to plant, where, what kind of little earthworks or large earthworks to do, whether it's an urban or a large-scale design. They want to know, like, do these plants really yield well together? They want someone to come out, walk their property, give them some ideas, give them maybe a bubble diagram or something like that, and maybe come back two or three times when they're doing some work and give them some advice while they're doing it. This is a dream customer. This is the best thing you can have because they're going to phase their work in over time. That means they're going to call you back as a consultant multiple times. That means they're going to pay you multiple times. That means they're probably going to become your friend. Don't be afraid to take money from your friends. If you would not take money from a friend, the problem is the value you're delivering, not the fact that they're a friend. I will happily take money from a friend because I know I'm going to give them just as good, if not better, service than I would give any customer. And if I was embarrassed to take money from a friend, I would be embarrassed to deliver my product to a stranger. So property planning is great because it cultivates friendships and relationships and social capital and intellectual capital, which can be used to grow more business. Full design. This is the end-to-end planning with professional design. Trees drawn in. Everything's to scale. Top high-end looking design. This is your whole project. Here it is, customer. You need to charge a lot for the artistic component to that because not everybody can do it. I can teach anybody to draw a bubble diagram in 5 minutes. I can't do full design. I don't know how, and I don't know how to have the time. And if I went into the business of delivering that as part of my consultancy, I would have a person who I contracted, not employed, at least initially, I would use a contractor, and I would say, how much does it cost to do this type of work? And I would build that rate in, cost plus 25 to my customer. 25% margin on somebody else's work. That's fair. It's reasonable, and it's enough to make it worthwhile for me to do it. And it doesn't price me out of my business. And if I had a person that was too expensive on the design side, I'd find someone that's good and not as expensive. And I would work on that end of things before I started going to my customer and asking for more than is reasonable. You got to understand where to prune. That should make sense to us in permaculture. Project management. This is on-site oversight of installation, earthworks, etc. When you go from the point of just saying, this is what I would do, and a little bit of just showing up and going, yeah, I'd make the mulch a little thicker there and all, where you're standing on site and the guy's bringing an earth mover in and you're like, yeah, we shot this contour line. You're digging a swale there and you're talking to the earth mover and like a little deeper, a little less deep. You're going back through with a laser level checking it, or you've got a big project going on. Guy brings in some friends to help. You're sheet mulching. You're on site. You're telling him exactly how to do it. You're there when he's planning. You're into a project management relationship. And you need to charge more for that. The amount of time that takes, you will underestimate it and probably lose money on your first couple jobs like this. You'll think it's not that big a deal, it'll be easy, and it won't be, and you'll learn how to price yourself fairly in time. It's okay. If you break even on the first two, call it good, and the education is better than you would get spending $20,000 for a year at a top university on business management. It absolutely is, and it's worth it. But try not to lose your butt. Seriously. In anything you do, you can only afford to pay to work so long. You can afford, while you can afford to pay to work, right? Like an internship that you pay for. And then after that, you can afford for a short period of time to work for free for experience. Once you have enough experience, you don't need to work for experience anymore. You need to work for money. So use the first couple, try to make some money on them, try to be fair with your customer, and learn what it really takes in your market for your style. And then doing the work. This is where you go in and you just tell the customer, just kick back and watch. I'll ask you some questions. I'm going to hire the earth mover. I'm going to do this. I'm going to bring the trees in for you. We're going to plant the trees. I've got employees. You are now a landscaper, a tradesman, etc. This changes the legal relationship. And in many places, you need a license to be a landscaper. You need a license to cut freaking grass in some municipalities. My solution to that is move. If you don't want to move, then you either get the licensing necessary or you partner with companies that already do this type of work, which is a great opportunity as well. If I was going to be in a consultancy and I knew that I would have customers eventually that would want the full-on installation, I would take on the role as a project manager and let the work be accomplished by any landscaping company under my direction. And eventually I'd find landscapers I can really work with. I would explain things to them from the beginning, like, if you bring chemicals onto the property that I'm working on, I'm going to punch you in the face. Do we understand each other? Then you might want to be a little bit more civil than that, but you need to make them understand. This is my project, and I am defining the roles of the project. I am contracting with you for you to deliver the work. And that means the work needs to be done by my design and my discretion. And if you're not comfortable with that, I'll find another partner. This is a conversation that no business owner should be offended by. And if you have a business owner that's offended by a clear, defined relationship, another lesson in business, do not do business with that person. They're not a grown-up business person. They are a child business person. Business people must be able to separate the professional from the personal. So you might hurt my feelings if you told me you didn't like a picture I drew if I was an artist. But if I was painting a house and you told me I did a poor job, I would understand that's business criticism and feedback. Right? Because there's a certain way that a house has to be painted. And when there's paint on the ceiling that's not supposed to be there, I've clearly screwed up. And I can't be hurt that you've pointed that out. And I can't be hurt that you would bring me in and say, this is the, you know, let's say I was going to be a person that sets up painting for customers. And I'd say, I want to walk you through a home that was done by one of my contractors, since you want to be one of them. And I want to show you the level of work that we expect. And you walk through and go, that's what we do. You shouldn't be offended by the fact that I've defined that for you. You should be actually quite excited to work with a business person that's that clear about their goals and their ethics and their morals and their expectations. So if you ever have someone that you have to have that direct conversation with, like when we do a permaculture design, it's probably different than what you're used to. And there's certain chemicals, like all of them, that we don't use. And there's certain procedures that you may be accustomed to that we don't do. I will always give you a clearly defined schedule of work, and I will ask you for a price based on that, but we need to not deviate from it based on your preconceptions about what needs to be done. Because I'm bringing work to you. And you want a person that says, that's awesome. And if you get anything else, there's lots of people in this business. Find somebody else. Next, the production revenue stream. Farming. You know, producing vegetative products for the market. There's a lot of opportunity there, but don't grow corn and beans. I mean, not that permaculturists generally do that, but, you know, looking into niche products is really the way to go. And products that will store at least a little bit is a great way to go as well, because it doesn't force you so much into a crunch. That's why I like ranching. Animal products have a higher return, especially initially, during establishment, and they can be used to establish a property. So if I was going to go into the production business and I wanted to make sure I was actually selling to market, either direct to customers or through a reseller, I would make sure that I was doing both a vegetable and animal model right from the beginning, not one to the exclusion of the other. The next thing I want to really make sure you understand, if you're in the production world, you want to get into value-added products. And this can also even go into seeds and plants, which I'll kind of cover as we bridge over to them in a second. But when we look at food, sauces, pickled eggs, etc., I've never actually, I think, gone to a farmer's market, walked it, and not ended up buying something that fits this category. I've been to lots of them where people are selling eggs, and I'm like, I have all the eggs I need. I grow chickens, and man, I gotta give eggs away. Though eggs to your neighbors is a great business model. I think in most neighborhoods, if you just walked around and said, hey, we do eggs for $3 a dozen from our own chickens in the backyard, you'd probably sell all the eggs you could handle producing. And that's another, that's like, you know, a gas money thing. And that's important that you start creating these little segments of money. But for instance, I went to a farmer's market in Fort Worth, all kinds of produce and everything. And it was the middle of summer and I had lots of my own, but I think we left with about $50 worth of stuff. And it was like pickled quail's eggs and different salsas we wanted to try and things like that. People like stuff like that. I know a girl who listens to my podcast, who got tired of working for a living, listened to the show, set up a business, and she sells salsas, tortillas, all types of things. She makes for herself. She has a full-time booth at the Arlington Farmers Market. She sells in a few other niche places. She's very excited about what she's doing. She can't grow 100% of her own produce, but she tries to put one thing from her backyard, a standard suburban backyard, into every product, just one thing. For instance, she has a amaranth tortilla, and instead of using amaranth grain, she grows the leaf amaranth. She dehydrates the leaves like dehydrated spinach, crumbles them up, and puts leaves into the tortillas, which are made with organic flour. So that product sells well for her because it's unique and it has a story to go along with it. And it's a value-added product. Think beyond picking the apple and selling the apple. Apple butter, apple jelly, apple cider, all are value-added steps for that apple. Feeding the windfall apples to pork and selling pastured apple-finished pork in the fall. Specifically marketing to people as, this is something that you don't see on everybody's Thanksgiving table. That's a product. That's a value-added product. Pasture-finished turkey for your Thanksgiving table. Everybody I've talked to has told me that started to do this and have like a locally produced pastured turkey on their Thanksgiving tables. Like, well, you better order one by March. And then you got people going out building $50,000 chicken houses to sell chickens to Tyson for 75 cents a bird, when people are selling turkeys for $70 or more a bird for a 15 to 22 pound bird and can't grow enough turkeys on pasture to fill the orders that people are ordering them in March. And you're telling me you need $100,000, $200,000. Some of these things are $250,000 to put in a chicken house that produces chickens at less than a dollar a chicken wholesale. This is where we have to start thinking value add and selling the value, the easy to understand value. Your turkey you feed your family will not have anything in it that will harm your family. And this turkey had a great life. And it comes from your local community. And by buying it, you're keeping dollars in your community. Easy to understand value. Easy to do business with. Come buy a turkey, here it is. Seeds are hugely profitable, and it's because they're valuable. And the more regionally adapted your seeds become, the better they are to sell into your local marketing. And also, propagating plants from those seeds and propagating perennials from cuttings and graftings, etc. And you can take that from a backyard nursery to large-scale production. I just went out and met with a gentleman named Bob Wells in Lindale, Texas. He's a sixth-generation nurseryman. He's clearly running a very successful business. And you think, well, what would it take to make a lot of money with a permaculture farm as far as land? And you would think, you know, 20 acres minimum, really, to really start to, you know, turn things on and have enough production. He's doing his business on about an acre and a half. And he's got, I think, a little orchard that's about an acre and another little piece of land that's, you know, like a half an acre. So in total, maybe 4 acres of property split up. He's selling all over the country because he's in the nursery business. Now, if he actually really was switched on to permaculture and was breeding permaculture plants, things that were specifically designed to go into permaculture guilds, and able to say, here's an apple guild, point click buy. How's that for a product? There's two apples that cross-pollinate well. There's a comfrey, right? There's a mint, like an apple mint, that goes well. And here's an apple guild for the north and an apple guild for the south. An Erm Shimmer and a Golden Orset in the south, and something like a Fuji and a Honeycrisp for the north. Now, with the permaculture understanding and a nursery, you can really turn things on. And I can tell you, I'm going to go into that business on some level. And I'm not afraid to tell you that. I believe we can do business pretty much open source in permaculture. The market's that big and that active and that growing. The day that we have too much competition in this market is one of two things. We've won, and we can all pat ourselves on the back when that happens. And that ain't tomorrow. Or two, we're all too narrow in what we're doing. Everybody teaching PDCs, yeah, we can saturate the market. Everybody doing all of these things will never saturate the market because you'll find what you're best at. And you'll attract the customers that want to buy from you at what you're best at. Now, getting really creative. Commercial site development, I think, is something that is an awesome opportunity. I pretty much have decided I will never deal with public works after one experience with it. It was awful. I already knew it was awful because I've dealt with it in the past and turned my back on it before, but figured, well, maybe permaculture will be different. Maybe government can do something well. The answer to that question is still no. In business, you want customers that are decision makers that you can say, here's your options, and they can say, I'm not sure, give me more information, yes or no. Those are very easy things to manage. You don't want customers fighting with each other, everybody with their own agenda, people that need 17 layers of approval. It's nonsense. In corporate sales, we call it selling to the C-level. If I want to sell a financial product, I want to talk to the CFO. He might defer me to one of his underlings, but if he's on board, I'm golden. Period. The end. Over. Out. Done. Well, when I'm selling a permaculture design, I want to sell it to the person that can say, yeah, go ahead and do it. Or, yeah, we're going to buy the design for you. Or, yeah, meet me here on Saturday and let's do a walkthrough and I'll pay your consulting fee for that and we'll take it from there. And if you go into public works, it's very hard to find that person. They can just say yes. But I think churches are massive. Here's a marketing phrase for you guys. If I were going to go into consulting and I wanted you to do site development and site implementation, I would make churches one of my many verticals, my vertical niches. I would put together a pamphlet just for churches. And on the front of it, I would put, feed your flock, feed your community. And you would open it up and it would say, taking community gardens to a new level. And it would talk a little bit about the community garden phenomenon and say, what if your system got healthier every year, never did any harm to your... Well, I'll save that for a little bit later in the presentation. But basically make them understand that we can put this system in without the ongoing maintenance and expense that the garden requires and create abundance that can be used to feed their community and feed their church itself at a much higher level for a much longer period of time and create a beautiful sanctuary for their parishioners to go to. I would go into apartment complexes. It might be a little harder, but I grew up in an apartment complex in Jacksonville, Florida in the 80s that was full of fruit, plums and pomegranates and figs. And it's part of why I love what I do today, because I grew up with that experience. So that's something you could look at. Private schools are different than public schools. Private schools, you can generally get to a couple people that run the whole damn show. There's not a school board. There's not government. It's like, yeah, this is what we, hey, let me show you the educational opportunities. Let me show you how you can be putting food into your cafeterias. I'm not saying this shouldn't be done in public schools. I'm saying I wouldn't do it. It's too much work. Private schools, I'd be all over it. They have money. They have quick, rapid decision-making capabilities. Corporate campuses. I know of corporate campuses that are massive, bigger than college campuses. So all of those are places I would look to do commercial site development opportunities. Farm and ranch co-management. You could set up a company in permaculture that says, we'll come to your farm and we'll run it for you. Here's the fee that we charge to do that. We'll develop long-term systems. So there'll be, but as long as we have to both have a long-term stake. More on this in a bit. This is where we're going with something on our side. And I'm not holding it back. I'm just saving it. We will tell you what we're doing. Property value increase. So a lot of people have seen things like property flippers, but it's really house flippers, right? So, you know, two brothers come in, they find this piece of crap house, they fix it up, they clean a bunch of cat turds out of it or whatever, and then they market it and they sell it and they buy it for $120,000, they put $50,000 worth of work into it, they sell it for $250,000 and make the spread. As long as they can get in there, get the work done, and get it on the market again as fast as possible, then they can make some money at it. Well, what if you flipped land that way? What if you went and found land? You were very selective with the land you bought. You looked at land that was just not taken well care of, but could be cleaned up and made to look good easily, just like the house. But it's actually easier than a house because you're doing your work with an excavator and a bulldozer. You only picked land with the right type of topography, the right type of soils. You could go in, put a couple dams, a couple swales in, set up a building site, not the infrastructure, not the electricity and gas and all, but you could have that done. And you could have it being sold with or without it. So property's ready to go, and market it to the permaculture community and market it to the huge community of people that want ranch land and things like that and explain what it is. Put together a whole video presentation on how a property like this evolves. Use footage from other permaculturists that will let you of places where food forests have been built and say this has all been put in. All you have to do is pick your stuff and plant it. By the way, we also have a service that does that for you with consulting, or you can just buy the land and go on about your business, or it's got three ponds on it, and that makes it worth more than no ponds. So you can just buy it with these ponds and know that everything around these swale things we put in will get really green and lush. It's up to you. But flipping properties, I think, has an opportunity. Niche production on the producer side. There's a guy that was on Diego Footer, who put together Permaculture Voices, his channel. I can't remember his name now. Older gentleman from Southern California who grows a few acres of jujubes. It's a little thing, kind of tastes like an apple, has one big pit in it. It's also known as Chinese date. He grows a bunch of different varieties. He sells all he can produce to the local Asian markets, mostly to the Chinese community. He said he's up on ladders in July, and the stuff's not going to be ready till August, the first crops. And the customer knows that, and they're on the phone calling him while he's on the ladder pruning a tree. Are they ready yet? And he's like, no, they won't be ready till August. And the guy's like, well, I knew they're not ready, but I called just in case. I'll call again next week. No, don't call next week. That's demand. So instead of growing things that like just a whole bunch of stuff, you can go into niche production. And it would make sense to go into your local markets, your local ethnic markets especially. This is not exploiting a market. This is finding opportunity and serving a market. Why will this Chinese community buy the crap out of jujubes from this man? Because they know of the product. Many of them who have come to California from Asia wish they could have it like they did at home where it was common. They can't find it, so when they do find it, they're excited and happy to purchase. So niche production. And I would ask you now, what other revenue opportunities can you think of that we could use in permaculture? Because the opportunities are endless, and the more you can put together, the more resilient you can build that business like we started off talking about. But I just want to tell you right now, and this is worth the entire presentation, how to sell permaculture. And you could use this to sell permaculture to a big project or a small urban design. This is how I would put it. Mr. and Mrs. Landowner, what we're able to do with permaculture is show you how you can better provide the highest quality food, and care for yourselves and your children. We can show you how to do this in a way that will never do any harm to your land or your neighbor's land. In fact, the land will become more fertile year after year. The techniques and materials we use will also never do anything to harm people, pets, or livestock. In fact, by eliminating toxic food and replacing it with food better than anything you can buy, your family can become healthier year after year. The best part is our systems generate surpluses in abundance, which can be continually reinvested so that you can always provide top quality food to your family and continuously improve the natural systems around you. This is something that actually matters. It applies directly to you and those you care about. It is something we can help you do now. No political actions required, no massive shift in your lifestyle, just a better way to live through a few gentle shifts we can help you accomplish over a single season or two. I am a professional salesperson. I spent 10 years of my life in corporate sales. I've managed sales forces producing over $65 million per annual term combined. And this is the best sales pitch that I could ever come up with to sell permaculture and what it can do for people to people. And all it is the prime directive and three ethics. The only ethical decision is to take responsibility for ourselves and that of our children, care of the earth, care of people, and reinvestment to the ends of the first two. And that is a sales formula. Because permaculture is a business model. And remember what I said, that you never want to oversell. This does not oversell permaculture. This is permaculture. If anything, this undersells permaculture. And by underselling, you give yourself the opportunity to overdeliver. That represents a growth market. People want to refer you when they're like, man, when you deal with these people, they do so much more than they promise. They go above and beyond. Everything they tell you they can do it plus. That's a successful business. On that, we're actually about to move on to our own business model, and I figured I would share that with you. Instead of hiding what we're doing, I can't tell you everything yet because there's a few things to be worked out as far as the nature of the client and the location, but we are about to take on our first client, and this one, since it's first, and this is a revolutionary thing, will actually be a client/partner in what we're doing. And I want you to realize something here. Flexibility and adaptability pay off. Too many entrepreneurs come up with an idea, and they say, this is my idea for my business. And then, like, they can't figure out how to make it work, and they won't go outside of the lines. They'll stay there. Those of you who have followed what I did with PermaEthos know that I didn't just define the boundaries. I publicly stated them, and I got people on board with them. It gets really hard to change then. But when you run into roadblocks, government, then you need to find ways around the roadblocks. You need to be flexible and adaptable. And often, your belief that you had found the perfect thing will turn out to be wrong, because in your flexing and adapting, you will find something better. This is what Jeff Lawton is talking about when he says that the more restrictions in a design, the more places you can't do what you would just do if you could, the more elegant and more amazing the final design becomes. So, in the beginning, PermaEthos was going to be a community, and that was all. A great big community of people living together in a permaculture way. Off-grid, maybe on-grid, we didn't know. Then we were going to do just a farm. And we were going to take in investors, and there were all kinds of challenges. And we figured some ways around that by doing co-ops and all, but it was still challenging. And then, because we were totally free and totally open with what we were doing, a group of people came to us and said, what if you did this with us? And they presented their idea. And not only did they present their idea to us, they already knew exactly what we wanted to do, because we weren't like, I'm going to hide my idea. So they are completely educated to who we are, what we're about, what we want to do, how we would do it. The dream client knows your business, and you've made it easy for them to ask to do business with you. We did it, and we didn't even know we were doing it, because we walk the talk. We do the things I'm telling you to do today. So we came up with a new mission statement after having these conversations. And in just a couple of weeks from the time that I recorded this, we'll be going on site with them to iron out the final plans on doing the first one. But as we looked at it, we said this doesn't take us away from our ability to own and manage our own properties either. So the mission statement of PermaEthos, and remember I said you should be able to do this in two sentences? PermaEthos establishes, manages, and builds thriving, community-based permaculture farms. Our farms profit from three primary revenue streams: agricultural production, plant and seed propagation, and educational programs. Now, as long as you understand the English language, and as long as you listen to what I say, what that business does is easy to understand. You might want to know more, and that's fine. But you know that we're building and managing farms. We're doing this in a community model, so it's more than just us and more than just farms, that we are producing things so that we can profit by selling them to the market directly in the form of food, that we are also going to be doing things from the standpoint of producing plants and seeds, and that we're going to be offering educational programs so people can learn how to do it themselves. In doing this, we're going to manage both client-owned and company-owned community farms. We'll develop groundbreaking and affordable web-based educational programs. When I say web-based, that doesn't mean everything will be online. It means a lot will be online. And we will cultivate not just plants. We're going to cultivate human beings. And that's where I want to give you one of my favorite quotes. This is by Masanobu Fukuoka. The ultimate goal of farming is not the growing of crops, but the cultivation and perfection of human beings. That's always struck with me since the very first time I read it. And now we have the opportunity to take that to another level, because what PermaEthos will cultivate through our educational programs is permaculture knowledge in our own unique way, in our own unique view. And that doesn't mean that it has to get in the way of anything anybody else is doing. It just means we have our own methods, our own thoughts, our own goals, our own objectives, and our own cultural and spiritual capital within our own organizations and communities. And that means that there's room for everybody, because everybody has that and everybody's unique. And there's so many people in this world that need what we're doing that each can choose what works best for them. But we're also going to cultivate human beings in the form of farmers and ranchers and nurserymen and producers, and not just those that come to us as pure students. Every person that works within PermaEthos will be training to move to a point where they're running a farm of their own someday, either within PermaEthos or set up and given every opportunity and advantage possible to saying, I want to go do this myself, and not fearing them as a competitor, but seeing them as a product that we have actually produced, yet another person who can do the things that we all say that we want done. That's a business model. And that's a goal bigger than ourselves. That's what we're trying to produce. And you can do this by running a small greenhouse-based backyard nursery that teaches plant propagation and sells plants to just your general neighborhood. Or you can do this with a massive undertaking like we're taking on. Or you can do it at any level in between. What you just have to remember is that businesses are about money. But money is not evil. The application of money can do things that are good or evil. Money is nothing but a symbol for energy, agreed upon by other human beings, to enable the exchange of value for value. And in your businesses, if you are delivering value that is equal to or exceeds that which you extract from your market, you're in a sustainable business. Building a sustainable business is building a business on the in the permaculture model.
It's in our food these days, you know, it's on our TVs. Sometimes we forget we are what we eat. I don't know the answer. It's like there's nothing I can do. It's the price we pay, I guess, when we follow all the rules. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. We'll show.